to explain to his client was that it didn't matter whose switches were more elegantly constructed. If Edison succeeded in suing him into oblivion, Westinghouse would be designing dynamos from a Bowery stockyard. Unless, continued Westinghouse, this was a display meant for me, not for you. He knew you would report back to me. And he wanted me to think he'd solved the distance problem. He wanted to scare me. Well, it has not worked, has it?
You don't much like lawyers, do you, sir? Said Paul.
A curious expression overtook Westinghouse's face. Paul had gotten his attention.
I don't blame you. Yet, right now, you are very much in need of one. And I need you to help me do my job.
Very well.
It is among my jobs to identify any course of action that might serve your interests, especially if you might not previously have been aware of it.
Westinghouse sat back in his chair. Paul couldn't tell whether he'd impressed his client with his speech or simply his gall.
I would like us to begin to ponder a compromise, suggested Paul.
A compromise that serves you and that best serves your products. Fair or not, this is the world in which we live. What precisely do you mean by a compromise?
That's not for me to say, said Paul diplomatically.
There are any number of different ways that some sort of compromise might be arranged. We can take some time to determine which might be most beneficial to you.
Such as?
A merger, for instance. The Westinghouse and Edison Electrical Company. Or call it the American Electrical Company, maybe. Take both of your names off it for simplicity's sake. Or, how about this? A licensing arrangement, such as we've made with Sawyer and Mann. You sell Edison's generators and pay him a royalty, while he sells your far superior bulbs and pays you a royalty. Or you sell each other's bulbs and each other's generators under a similar royalty scheme, and the consumers decide which they prefer.
Mine are better.
Westinghouse's simple, earnest statement tore a hole in their conversation.
All right.
What else could Paul possibly say?
Edison's bulbs break constantly. His generators need repair even more often than his shoddy telegraphs. Do you know the light bulbs he sells last half as long as mine and produce three-quarters the brightness? A product inferior in all ways, and yet people buy them by the cartload. He outsells me 4-1, despite the poverty of his constructions. Who knows why? Can't people tell that Edison is without the patience, not to mention the skill, the craft, to build quality products? EGE makes so very many things of such unprecedented breadth, and yet each one is, pardon, shit. They're shit. Edison makes shit, and he sells so much shit that no one notices that it's all shit. Shit is what Thomas Edison invented. I invented the light bulb. I perfected it, built it. It is the best in the world, and it is only getting better.
Paul's client reminded him of no one so much as Edison. The two men were perversely alike. Each was so confident of his own genius as to be disdainful of the others. Westinghouse's ego was no smaller than his enemies. Paul's first task, he realized, would not be to negotiate with Edison. It would be to negotiate with his own client.
I know, sir, said Paul. But what does it gain you to be the best if doing so drives you into bankruptcy? You run a business. It is one of the largest in this nation, and this business is presently facing a great variety of possible futures. You have options. It is my professional duty to see that you're aware of them.
Westinghouse's charcoal coat had been hung by the door. Without looking at Paul, he went to it and removed a folded piece of paper from the inside pocket. Gingerly, as if it were an object far more delicate than one of his machines, he carried it back and handed it over.
6 months ago, said Westinghouse, I wrote to Edison.
This was before you came on board. I suggested to him just such a compromise. I harbor no romantic dream of playing David to his Goliath. I know the odds against us. Everyone loves an underdog, but that doesn't mean he's a sound investment. So I wrote, and I attempted conciliation. This was his response. Paul looked down at the letter. It was from Thomas Edison himself, and it consisted of one word. Never. So, kid, said Westinghouse after Paul had spent a few moments taking this all in, you're supposed to be some kind of legal virtuoso. Prove it. Chapter 5. The Curious Case of U.S. Letters Patent Number 223,898. I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that don't work. Thomas Edison. Who invented the light bulb? This was the topic at hand. Technically, the litigation was between the Edison Electric Light Company and the Mount Morris Electric Light Company, but everyone knew that these were subsidiaries and legal proxies for their parent companies. Even the attorneys litigating this $1 billion case called it simply Edison v. Westinghouse. The issue before them? U.S. Letters Patent Number 223,898, granted to Thomas Edison on January 27, 1880. Which described the invention of an incandescent electric lamp. Quickly nicknamed the light bulb patent by the press, it was without question the most valuable patent ever granted in the history of the United States. And George Westinghouse was accused of infringing on it. Yet, as Paul pointed out to his client, even a problem so simply put might yet admit to many layers of unraveling. In fact, the question hinged on one's precise definition of the terms involved. Who invented the, and most importantly, light bulb? The first electric lamps had actually been invented almost a century before. Paul had learned when he'd first begun to research the case. Sir Humphrey Davy had publicly demonstrated early arc lights in 1809. By attaching a battery to two charcoal sticks, he'd caused a U-shaped thread of electricity to arc across the gap between the sticks. The explosion of light was blindingly bright, perfect for lighting dark outdoor areas if it could be tamed into safety and reliability. And over the following decades, tamed it was. Michael Faraday created the first hand-cranked electrical generators in the 1830s by moving magnets through fields of coiled wire. The improbably named Belgian inventor Zenobie Théophile Gramme improved upon Faraday's generators and then created the first electrical motor by simply building the generator's inverse in the 1870s. By 1878, the American Charles Brush was selling massive outdoor arc lighting systems to cities and towns all around the nation. Across the globe, a Russian named Paul Yablochkov was selling what he called electrical candles, much smaller than Davy's original arc lights, but constructed on the same principle. These candles were almost suitable for indoor use. Almost. None of these early iterations were fit for the home. No wife in America would sanction the installation of a lamp that was confusing to use, expensive to repair, and more likely than not to set the drapes on fire. Plus, there was the quality of the light itself. It was horrific, ugly, displeasing to the human eye at close quarters. The electricity that arced between the sticks remained too elemental. The heat seared too violently. Gas lamps remained far safer and far more beautiful. That's when Thomas Edison, already the most celebrated inventor in the world for his work on the telegraph and the telephone, entered the scene. On September 16, 1878, Edison took to the pages of the New York Sun to proclaim that he had solved the problem of creating a reliable
safe, and most importantly, pleasing indoor illumination. He had invented an incandescent electric lamp. He told the adoring press that he would have all of Lower Manhattan wired for indoor electrical light within months. The day that Edison announced this discovery, the stocks of all the major gas companies in the United States and Britain plunged more than 20%. The scientific community was less impressed. Academics responded from their university perches first with skepticism and then with outright derision. It was impossible, they claimed. There was no way to steady an even current through a filament to create a gentle and constant glow. Electricity was unruly. It was not like kerosene or shale oil, natural elements created by God and crafted by man for his purposes. Electricity was a force. Taming electrical current would be like bending gravity to man's will, like traveling through time. There were some things in this world with which not even science could mess about. Edison's soft glow violated all the accepted laws of physics. And so, Paul learned from the old newspapers he'd pored over in his office, Edison had held a series of private demonstrations. Only a select few reporters and potential investors were invited. The men who would fund this enterprise, to be called the Edison General Electric Company, were let in to see the lit bulbs for only a few minutes at a time. They were never shown the blueprints. And yet these men were stunned by what they saw in a guarded back room. For the first time in their lives, they witnessed a new kind of light. They described it breathlessly in their papers, their magazines, their journals, their stockholder reports. Paul had read them all that spring 10 years later. The men wrote as if they'd discovered a new color, and they had named it Edison. On November 4, 1879, over a year after announcing his device in the press, Thomas Edison finally filed his patent for the incandescent light bulb. Paul kept a copy of that patent application atop his desk and stared at it every day. Within it rested the fate of his whole case. If the patent held, no one but Edison could manufacture and sell incandescent bulbs within the United States. If Paul could not break the patent claim, Thomas Edison would have a monopoly on light itself. The story of Edison's invention had been laid out plainly and the patent awarded easily. But in Paul's profession, no story was ever this simple. With only the slightest change of perspective, the subtlest of reframings, Edison's story might be made to yield the most contrary of impressions. So, who invented the light bulb? First, who? Edison was far from a lone wolf in his lab. How many others helped him? If the work of others had been used to create Edison's lamp, was their work his property, or might another man lay claim to part of Edison's supposed breakthrough? Moreover, 1,000 other laboratories across the United States and Europe had been at work on this very problem. Might Edison have used ideas that were first developed elsewhere and published in one of the many popular engineering journals? Theft was theft, whether it was intentional or not. Second, invented. Was Edison's incandescent lamp a fundamentally new invention, or was it simply an improved version of an earlier device? The law stated that for a patent to be valid, the invention described must constitute a major breakthrough. A man can't simply tweak another's device and call the resulting machine his own. It must be a truly new thing. Hadn't Joseph Swan already taken out patents on incandescent lamps? Hadn't Sawyer and Mann? What made Edison's incandescent bulb different from the others? What made it an invention? Third, the. Perhaps the trickiest word of them all. Even if Edison was the one who did the inventing, and even if inventing is what occurred,
Did he actually invent the light bulb? Or just a light bulb? Why the definite article? There could be as many varietals of light bulb as roses blooming in the gardens of Central Park. What made Edison's preeminent? The lawyers for Edison General Electric Company were not claiming that Edison held a patent on one specific design of one light bulb. They claimed that the patent covered all designs of all light bulbs. They argued that no other company had a legal right to manufacture incandescent bulbs because incandescent light itself was covered by Edison's patent. This was the very heart of the matter. George Westinghouse and Eugene Lynch and Elihu Thompson and the dozens of other competitors were each selling different lamps. Westinghouse's were shorter and featured straight, unwound filaments, not coiled ones. Eugene Lynch's had featured a wider base before the unfortunate incident of the flaming workman had lurched his company toward insolvency. Were not all these things members of the infinite and diverse variety of objects we might refer to as light bulbs? Paul could suggest, carefully and with great logic, that Thomas Edison might have patented a specific light bulb, but he could not patent the entire idea of a light bulb. He might be able to prevent Westinghouse from selling one particular design of bulb, but he could not stop his competitors from manufacturing any kind of bulb at all. And finally, that magical new term itself, light bulb. No one even knew where it came from or who had coined it. Light had only been coming from bulbs for a few years now since Thomas Edison. The term had caught on and become commonplace. Yet a lawyer in Paul's position was duty-bound to ask, to what did the words truly refer? What made something a light bulb? The law stated that for a device to be patentable, it must be non-obvious. A man couldn't take out a patent on something that already existed. A turkey sandwich, for instance. Hungry Americans had been lunching on such sandwiches for generations. But more important, you also couldn't patent a turkey sandwich with sauerkraut on top, even if you might in fact be the first person in America to put together a combination that disgusting. Any drunken chef might have done it by accident. And so, the question needed to be asked. If Thomas Edison and his phalanx of attorneys claimed that his patent covered the whole idea of a light bulb, well, wasn't the idea of a light bulb in the air already? Had men not been frantically working to build such a thing for decades? Hadn't engineers and scientists been discussing the possibility of this light bulb concept since 1809? The idea of a light bulb was hardly non-obvious. Only Edison's one particular schematic, admittedly, quite clever, was. Paul was simply offering that Edison's work on the light bulb was the tallest evergreen in the Appalachian Mountains. Magnificent and noteworthy, laudable even, but also a single sprout amid a much larger growth. So who had invented the light bulb? The answer, according to Paul's reasoning, was that it depended. And that it was not the place of the federal government to suffocate innovation in its cradle while the field was so new. To say that Thomas Edison had invented the light bulb was bad for free enterprise. It was bad for scientific progress. It was bad for business. It was bad for consumers. And it was bad for the United States of America. "You know," said Westinghouse finally after Paul had spent some hours largely in monologue laying out this strategy for his client, "you were right about me before. I don't like lawyers." Westinghouse looked at the sun setting outside the squat laboratory windows. "But as lawyers go, you might be halfway decent." Chapter 6 Locusts. I can always hire mathematicians, but they can't hire me. Thomas Edison. That spring, the light bulb lawsuits descended like locusts upon the land. The filings swarmed on the coast, New York, Washington, Philadelphia, before sweeping west across the plains. The assault was biblical. The mood among the attorneys, apocalyptic. Paul had never seen anything like it, because no one had. He was aware of previous patent disputes. Skirmishes over various aspects of the telegraph had been popping up for decades. The sewing machine, now a common appliance in any decent home, had produced a thunderous volley of claims and counterclaims. But those were small beer to this. Not only were there now 312 separate lawsuits between Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse, but there were dozens of other smaller electrical companies who were suing and being sued by one another with equal vigor. Carter would check in on Paul periodically from his adjacent office, feigning helpfulness, inquiring as to whether Paul could use any advice. Paul declined the offers of his one-time mentor easily. Hughes was sneakier, though, approaching Paul obsequiously in search of advice. Paul had to give the man credit, both for persistence and for being so transparently phony that it barely counted as subterfuge. Inept lying was almost as good as honesty. My clients at National Steel sure would be tickled pink if they knew their contracts were getting a second look by the genius who represents George Westinghouse. Paul couldn't refuse, but he also knew enough of Hughes's competitive ambitions to keep the man as far away from the files as possible. "Say, Cravath," began Hughes one spring afternoon as he entered Paul's office. His square face and prematurely thinned hair gave him a look of thoughtfulness. "There's been something gnawing at me of late. It seems to me that if Edison is out there plotting against us, we might want to think a bit about just what he's got in store." Paul took note of Hughes's unsubtle use of us and we, but did not comment on it. Hughes shut the door behind him conspiratorially. "Have you thought about acquiring a spy?" Paul set down his straight-capped waterman. The pen had by that point left a permanent scar on his finger. Even a brief respite felt pleasant. "A spy?" he asked. "In Edison's shop, someone to leak his plans, his strategy." "A spy sounds melodramatic." "I can help us find one." Hughes slapped a newspaper upon Paul's desk. Looking down, Paul saw that it was the morning's New York Times. Not the city's most egregious Edison sycophants, but far from the least either. The story to which Hughes gestured was buried behind a dozen columns of financial news and agony pages. The headline read, "Edison Fires Senior Staff." And the article went on to describe a bloodbath of spring firings, a dozen engineers who'd been let go from Edison's laboratory. "Thomas Edison cannot sneeze without it becoming national news," said Hughes. "The papers have him under closer scrutiny than we ever could." "Why is he firing his top people?" "Because he's in need of someone to blame. What if something in Edison's laboratory isn't working the way he wants it to? So he's going through engineers until he finds someone who can get whatever it is to function." This was an intriguing possibility. Paul hadn't been thinking the matter through from Edison's perspective. What troubled the great man perched high in his Fifth Avenue office? What remained unaccomplished by the man who could light up the Statue of Liberty with a touch of a button? "It's the distance," Paul realized. "He still can't get the distance to work. Like the statue."
"What statue?"
"Lady Liberty. Westinghouse explained it to me once, or he tried at any rate. Electrical current of the sort Edison and Westinghouse are both manufacturing cannot travel more than a few hundred feet. It can't go from Edison's office on Fifth Avenue all the way down to... it doesn't matter. But Westinghouse was positive on the point. It does not matter how large a generator you build, electrical current can't venture more than the length of a city block."
"Why?"
"I have no idea. But Westinghouse suggested that it's a terrible problem. His own men go sleepless failing to solve it. Installing generators every few blocks, as both companies are forced to, is extremely expensive, not to mention inefficient. Hughes pointed down at the names of Edison's now former employees. This man right here, mentioned in the article. Reginald Fessenden. He's one of Edison's top engineers. Worked directly beneath Charles Batchelor. Which means that he'd most certainly have been engaged on this distance problem, and even better, the Times says he's been with EGE for 4 years. So? So, if I spent 4 years working for a man, giving him my very best every day, and then was unceremoniously fired one morning because I'd failed, and my entire team had failed, to solve a problem that no one else could solve either, I'd have a bit of an axe to grind. Chapter 7 Rivalries. In any machine, the failure of one part to cooperate properly with the other part disorganizes the whole and renders it inoperative for the purpose intended. Thomas Edison. Reginald Fessenden was even younger than Paul. Neither his thick beard nor the long handlebar mustache that bridged it helped him to look any older. Yet, when Fessenden spoke, he adopted a professorial air. His chin would rise high as he peered beneath his spherical bifocals, and his words would flow slowly. He lectured like an old man. Paul reasoned that Fessenden had every reason to play the professor since he'd recently found employment as one. After his sudden departure from EGE, he'd been offered a position teaching electrical engineering at Indiana's Purdue University. In no time at all, he'd found himself going from designing vacuumed glass tubes on Fifth Avenue to teaching basic motors amid the Indiana cornfields. When Paul visited him in his undecorated office on the Purdue campus 2 weeks after the conversation with Hughes, Fessenden didn't seem pleased about this unexpected course his career had taken. Thomas Edison can burn in hell. The blue Midwestern morning poured through the muntin-sashed windows. The air felt clean, though Paul did not. He had barely slept on the night train in. He hadn't had time to change clothes. He hid the wrinkles in his white shirt under his black overcoat. So you didn't leave Edison's employ willingly? Paul asked, playing dumb. Well, should have. He's a fool if he thinks he can get along without me. Us. Without all of us. It was a massacre in there. Something about the price of his stock. His war against your client is costing him quite a bit of capital. It's not my damned job to care about his stock, I'll tell you. It was my job to design his machines, and I was doing quite exceptionally fine at it. What about the distance problem? Fessenden's eyes narrowed. Why do you ask? Paul explained that he was in need of help. That to win Westinghouse's case against the man who'd done them both wrong, who'd kneecapped Fessenden's career just as he'd poisoned Westinghouse's with libelous charges of intellectual theft, he would need to know as much as he could about the inner workings of Edison's laboratory. He wanted to know about its operation today as well as some years back when Edison had first patented the light bulb. Fessenden possessed information, Paul explained, that could do a lot more good in Paul's hands than his own. Fessenden took this in quietly. His face betrayed nothing. It was only when Paul had finished that he raised an eyebrow and asked a very telling question. And what? Exactly, Mr. Cravath. Is it that you're offering me? Paul wanted to smile. These scientists were all businessmen in their hearts. I get the impression, said Paul, that you might be in need of a new job. He gestured out the window toward the open expanse of Indiana fields. In the distance, a pair of old workhorses carried pails of water across the arid dirt. He'd prepared the offer days before. Pittsburgh, Westinghouse's laboratory. head of engineering. When Paul described the position, Fessenden's lips quivered. Would George Westinghouse, Fessenden asked, really offer such a senior position to someone so young? Well, Paul answered, I might be able to think of another fairly senior position in his organization that he offered to someone a good deal younger than expected. When Fessenden leaned back, the rusty wheels of his chair squeaked. You enjoy it there? Paul shrugged. If you can find a better position somewhere else, do let me know. Fessenden grinned. Okay, he said. I'm in. They signed the paperwork then and there. The terms were generous enough that Fessenden did not bother to consult his own attorney. He would be extremely well compensated. So, what do you want to know? Fessenden asked as Paul slipped his fountain pen back in his pocket. The answer was, quite a bit. How did Edison's laboratory function? What was its organizational structure? Though Fessenden hadn't been there when Edison filed for the light bulb patent, what had he heard from the men who had? Edison dictated the problems, Fessenden explained. We solved them. Experimentation, that's how he did it. Endless, tedious experimentation. Invention, you know, it isn't like the way the press describes it. It's not Edison in a dark room with a box full of wires. It's a system. It's industry. It's the man at the top. Thomas saying, we're going to build a light bulb. Here are all the ways people have tried to build light bulbs before. They don't work. Now, let's you lot find a way that does. And then he'd set 50 of us on that task for a year. And eventually, a light bulb. So, said Paul, excited. Edison was, in fact, making use of existing technologies in his light bulb design. Well, of course. Did he look at any of the pre-existing patents? Sawyer and Mann, Houston. I wasn't there, of course, but based on what I know, he must have. Paul's heart sped. This was everything he'd hoped to hear. Which ones? I'm sure he looked at all the previous patents, Mr. Cravath. But not in the way you're thinking. Thomas wasn't using them to see how he should solve a problem. He used them to see how he shouldn't. Paul's heart sank as Fessenden continued. That's how Thomas works. It's not, what's the right answer? It's, let's try every answer until we find one that isn't wrong. And the intellectual property that your client owns? Thomas was very pleased by how wrong those answers were. Paul was dejected. He pressed on for some hours, but Fessenden gave him nothing that helped. According to everything Fessenden had learned, Edison truly had developed his light bulb design in his own laboratory. Paul had never heard of anything quite like Edison's factory full of geniuses. Westinghouse was responsible for tremendous feats of manufacturing. Extremely well-built devices made by a factory of hundreds, each one supplying a part. A chain of construction. Edison, on the other hand, had built himself a factory that did not produce machines, but rather ideas. An industrial process of invention. Hundreds of engineers set to work on a great problem from the top down, each man in charge of his own small part. In this way, they could tackle problems more difficult than anyone else's. It was ingenious. It was annoyingly, confoundingly, disastrously ingenious. The sun was just starting to descend toward the cornfields by the time Paul finished. It had been a long and unproductive interview. Fessenden would head to Pittsburgh the following week to begin work in Westinghouse's laboratory. He'd be questioned again by the engineers, but Paul did not hold out much hope that this would produce much of use. Perhaps there was a spare technical detail that might benefit the lab, but he had found nothing that could help the legal case on which that lab's existence depended. I'm sorry, said Fessenden as Paul rose to his feet. I fear this wasn't as helpful as you'd hoped. Mr. Westinghouse will have his own questions, no doubt, but I'm quite satisfied. There was no point in making Fessenden feel dejected. Westinghouse would need him at full enthusiasm when he arrived. You know, said Fessenden offhandedly as Paul shook awake his legs, if you're interested in finding another former engineer of Edison's who might toss you more dirt than I have, there's a man you might look up. I'd be grateful. Who is he? An awful jerk, but that might come in handy given your present needs. He's an engineer's engineer, if you catch my meaning. Conversation is not his strong suit. Speaks with this impenetrable accent. Serbia, I think? Fresh from the South Street docks, still smelling of sea salt, he got a job at EGE a few years ago. Roundly hated by everyone from the very minute he arrived, which was likely the only accomplishment he managed during his tenure. You couldn't deny that he was smart, but it wasn't much use. He couldn't work with anyone, always off on his own projects. Finally, he and Edison got in some terrific row. Nobody ever found out what it was about. But we could hear the yelling. Charles Batchelor had to escort the poor man from the building. That was the last we saw of him. 3 years ago, perhaps, it was. But if you're looking for somebody who'd be eager to speak ill of Edison, he might be the man for you. Fessenden looked to the ceiling as he muttered, if you can manage to understand a word out of his mouth. His name? Asked Paul, removing his fountain pen. Chapter 8. The Ghost of Nikola Tesla. I don't mind being, in the public context, referred to as the inventor of the World Wide Web. What I like is that image to be separate from private life, because celebrity damages private life. Tim Berners-Lee. Nikola Tesla was dead. Or, if he wasn't, Paul felt he might as well be. Not a soul had heard from him since his sudden and angry departure from Edison's lab 3 years previous. The community of electrical engineers, so Paul was learning, was tight-knit. They talked, they gossiped. Trading between firms, such as Fessenden had just done in coming to work for Westinghouse, was not uncommon, which made it all the more remarkable that Tesla had not been heard from at all. No one had spoken to him. No one had seen him. No one had received a letter from him. No one had gotten a telegram from him. Perhaps, Paul reasoned, he'd returned to Europe. Perhaps he'd gone into another line of work entirely. Or perhaps he'd fallen to tuberculosis. It was as if, having jettisoned the coils of Edison's lab, Tesla had jettisoned the mortal one as well. He was a ghost. An amusing anecdote passed from engineer to engineer. Do you remember that tall fellow? Funny accent. What a loon. Whatever became of him, do you think? Nothing at all, apparently. On Paul's next trip to Westinghouse's estate, he sought to mention the missing engineer to his employer along with updates on his recent courtroom appearances. His strategy, thus far, amounted to little more than stalling for time. And yet time, if it could be acquired, might prove quite valuable. Edison's patent on the light bulb expired in 6 years. If Paul could argue his way against any definitive rulings against them for such a length of time, they'd be in the clear. Losing very slowly was almost as good as winning. When Paul arrived, the butler informed him that the main house's portico was being repainted. Would Mr. Cravath mind coming around to the back? Paul tried to shake the thought that this might be a sign of something. He sat on a small chair that had been placed in a back hallway, and the minutes drew on. Paul waited for over an hour in the quiet hall. He had papers to read in his briefcase, but he didn't take them out. If Westinghouse was proving a point, then so would Paul. He would not appear bored or distracted when Westinghouse arrived. When Paul finally heard his name,
He turned to see Marguerite Westinghouse regarding him with concern. Her arms were crossed in front of her. The lady of the house's white hair was done up stylishly. If Marguerite had ever committed an inelegant act in her life, Paul had seen no signs of it.
"Paul," she said familiarly, "don't tell me my husband has kept you waiting."
"It's been no trouble, ma'am." Marguerite smiled. Of course it had.
"You are an exceedingly polite young man. Come with me."
Paul followed Marguerite through the house all the way to the large white kitchen. Standing before the threshold, Marguerite paused.
"George likes to do this with all of the young men," she said as she turned to Paul.
"Oh." The words that echoed through Paul's head were, "all of the young men." He was simply the latest in a line of protégés for the great George Westinghouse. Marguerite's gesture of sympathy had the unintended effect of making Paul feel even less secure in his position.
"You're doing well," she said, seemingly predicting his thoughts. "But would you mind some advice? George spends most of his days in the factory, not the laboratory. He loves to watch his things as they're built."
Paul was unsure of her point.
"The factory floor is quite loud, you see," she continued as Paul clearly failed to catch her meaning. "Speak up when you talk to him. Sometimes it may seem like he's being rude, but actually, he's just having a hard time hearing you."
Paul smiled. He thought back on the many unprompted and disorienting turns into which Westinghouse had pivoted their conversations. This went far toward explaining them. He was impressed yet again by Marguerite. She hadn't told him this to betray her husband's confidences. Rather, she'd done so because she knew that Paul's help was the very thing her husband needed. When she led Paul into the kitchen, they found George Westinghouse seated on a stool. He was hunched over a bowl of what Paul quickly determined was salad dressing.
"I found your attorney in the hallway, darling," she said. "If you leave him there too long, we'll have to invite him to dinner."
Westinghouse looked up, registering the gentle rebuke from his wife. "Come in, come in," he said simply. Marguerite seemed to take that as her cue to leave them alone. Paul spoke loudly as he updated Westinghouse on the 312 lawsuits against them. Continuances, delays, postponements, these were Paul's best tools. His argument that Westinghouse's light bulb was not in violation of Edison's patent would come next, though as slowly as he could manage. Westinghouse gave a few grunts of acknowledgement. It was only when Paul got to the small matter of a former Edison employee that Westinghouse perked up. "Tesla?"
"Yes, sir. He's vanished into the breeze."
"Nikola Tesla?"
"Yes, sir," said Paul even louder. Marguerite's advice was not proving as helpful as he'd hoped.
"Where have I heard that name before?"
"I'm afraid I don't know."
"Strange name." Westinghouse seemed to be rolling it around on his tongue, as if its incantation would help him place its origin. Suddenly, he stood and led Paul to the mansion's book-lined study. Paul realized that he hadn't been back in this room since his first visit to this house those long months before.
"Tesla, Tesla," said Westinghouse as he flipped through a large pile of letters on his desk.
It looked like overdue correspondence awaiting replies. Paul found it hard to imagine that Westinghouse kept current in his letter writing.
"Here it is," said Westinghouse with satisfaction. "A letter from Thomas Martin. He's a scientist, sometime journalist. He edits a technical journal, name of Electrical World."
"I can't claim to be a subscriber." "Pity." Westinghouse handed the letter to Paul, revealing beneath its cover note another sheet, on which was depicted a very detailed mechanical schematic. Paul could not make either heads or tails of the design, but he could attest to its complexity. Paul looked the letter over.
"Your friend Mr. Martin claims that he received these schematics from a stranger named Nikola Tesla, who requested that he publish them?"
"And Martin, his interest piqued by the daring nature of the designs, asked if I'd be so kind as to give them a look,"
to determine if they were at all manufacturable.
Manufacturable?
It's one thing to design something, kid. Even Thomas Edison designs all manner of junk. It's another thing entirely to design something that can be practically built, a thing that will work. That is what a real inventor does. He designs manufacturable devices.
Is Tesla's design manufacturable?
Westinghouse took the letter back before answering.
I had some of the boys look into it. It's interesting, I'll give your ghost that. But it's decidedly half-formed. Would take months of work to hone it into something that might be built.
Does the letter come with Tesla's address, with a way for me to find him?
No, answered Westinghouse. But it comes with a way for me to do so.
He gestured again to the schematics.
Mr. Martin has agreed to publish the schematics. He's also asked that Tesla prove the efficacy of his design with a public demonstration. Martin has gotten Tesla to agree to present his work before the American Institute of Electrical Engineers, an organization of which I am, you may have reasoned, a member.
The demonstration would be in New York in only a few weeks. If Paul wanted to interrogate Tesla about his work in Edison's lab, he was welcome to be Westinghouse's guest. As they returned to the laboratory to discuss other matters, Paul was encouraged. He had no idea what he was to make of this mysterious Mr. Tesla. But any enemy of Edison's was bound to be a friend of Westinghouse's. Chapter 9. Mr. Tesla has something he would not like to show you. Science may be described as the art of systematic oversimplification, the art of discerning what we may, with advantage, omit. Karl Popper. 3 weeks later, Paul led George Westinghouse through the evening crowds along 47th Street. Westinghouse was clearly no admirer of New York. The commotion, the bustle, and most likely even the noise overwhelmed him. He told Paul with pride that he hadn't been to Manhattan in over 2 years. This Mr. Tesla would need to put on quite a show to justify breaking such a successful streak. The two men arrived at the corner of Madison Avenue, where before them rose the blocks-long campus of Columbia College. They entered onto the grassy lawns to the echoing St. Thomas Church. Paul had not been back to his alma mater in some time. The sensation, as he stepped between the gray slabs of Greek Revival buildings, was one of time travel. He walked past the former institution for the deaf and dumb. The property had been bought by the savvy trustees of Columbia years earlier. New wings were being added to nearly every building as the college expanded. The law school lay closer to 49th Street on the north end of the campus. As Paul gazed at the unkempt students on the lawn, he felt impossibly old. Was it only a few years before that he had been this young? To be a stranger in the place of your coming of age, to be an old man to your peers but a young man to your partners, these were the signs of generational displacement endemic to the young and successful. Paul felt an instinctive desire to be back here, to be a student again with so much to prove. And yet he remembered how tense and unhappy those years had been. He had found himself the poor Tennessee boy among the moneyed children of New York royalty. He'd thought he'd met a well-to-do crowd, sons of merchants and railroad men, at Oberlin, but that was only because he'd never met the truly affluent. He had never felt poor before Columbia. As Paul led Westinghouse into the engineering school, he noticed he was far from the only postgraduate walking under the new stone archway. Clearly the publication of Tesla's designs had served as some advertisement that tonight's lecture would be far from ordinary. Whatever ordinary might mean in an organization so young as the American Institute of Electrical Engineers, and in a field so untested. As he and Westinghouse settled into two empty seats near the back of the long hall, Paul saw a familiar face several rows closer to the podium. Charles Batchelor winked as their eyes met. And then Batchelor turned away, lost in the sea of engineers. So, Thomas Edison was tracking Tesla too. Of course he was. The schematics that Thomas Martin had published in Electrical World a week before were incomplete. They suggested the beginnings of some new device, but gave little indication as to its function. Yet, evidently, whatever Tesla had sketched had the potential to be quite revolutionary. No one knew precisely what Tesla was to unveil. Westinghouse had said that, based on the schematics, it could be one of 100 different electrical devices. The mystery only served to increase the potential. They waited for half an hour. The longer the delay, the greater the expectations became. The chattering of the tightly packed crowd grew louder and more insistent with every minute in which Tesla failed to appear. The seats creaked under the weight of their gossip. Finally, the main doors opened to reveal Thomas Martin, identified by Westinghouse, leading a man who could only be Nikola Tesla into the hall. Tesla was shockingly thin, easily 6.5 feet tall, with a delicately curled mustache and a part dead in the center of his slick black hair. Paul's first thought was that he must be on loan from P.T. Barnum's circus. Tesla appeared immaculate in his stiffly pressed suit and thickly greased hair, and yet utterly uncomfortable as he was literally yanked to the stage by his host. Martin deposited Tesla awkwardly into a reserved seat in the front row before immediately stepping up to the podium. Everyone settled in for the evening's performance. "I will begin by stating the obvious," said Martin with a commanding voice. "Our guest of honor does not want to be here." The joke was greeted by a warm chuckle from the crowd. Martin was as close to an Eminence Grise as New York's engineering community possessed. Science was becoming a young man's game, if the composition of this audience was any indication, and the white of Martin's beard made clear that he no longer was one. "Nikola Tesla is a genius," continued Martin, "and like many geniuses, he is a deeply private man. However, he has allowed himself to be convinced that on this one night he should share his particular genius with us. Discoveries such as his, I am sure you will shortly realize, were never meant to remain in the dark." Paul could read the satisfaction in Martin's slight smile. Ownership. That's what Martin was imparting upon the crowd. Tesla was his discovery. By extension, whatever it was that Tesla would bring into the world, Martin was laying a claim to as well. "Gentlemen," continued Martin, "if you'll permit me one last unorthodoxy, I will not bore you with further introduction of your guest of honor. He has requested that the details of his life before this moment go unmentioned, as they have little bearing on tonight's proceedings. So I will honor his wish, and without further ado, I present to you my friend and colleague, Nikola Tesla. He has something he would not like to show you." It took a moment for the applause to catch up with the speech. Martin had already bounded away from the podium. Tesla ascended toward the great chalkboard at the front of the room, then turned to face the crowd. He kept his hands in his pockets as he stared off into the distance. The applause died down, but Tesla seemed not to notice. He placed no notes before him on the lectern. He did not reach for the chalk or do anything else that might convey to an observer that he was, in fact, about to deliver a lecture. Tesla continued staring into a vague and uncertain distance. Whatever world this man occupied, he was its only inhabitant. He seemed completely unaware of the existence of the hundreds assembled before him, prepared to hang on his every word if only he'd be so kind as to utter a few. "Please pardon my face," came Tesla's high-pitched and thickly accented voice. "My pallor is white as pale. My health is in a condition dishabille."
Between the muddle of his Serbian accent and the bizarre nature of his syntax, it took Paul a few moments to determine that Tesla was, in fact, speaking in English. It was soon clear that his command of the raw materials of the language, words, short phrases, was deep, and yet his use of its intricacies, grammar, sentence construction, was haphazard. It was as if Tesla tossed up into the air all the words he knew on a given subject, and then walked away before he could see where they landed.
"Laboratories are better fit places for machines than personages," continued Tesla. "But I am digressed. The notice I received for tonight's lecture was rather small, and I have not been able to treat the subject so extensively as desired. My health, I have said. I ask your kind indulgence, and my gratification shall be in your minor approvals."
And with that, Nikola Tesla marched out of the room. Chapter 10. Alternating Current. Always remember that it is impossible to speak in such a way that you cannot be misunderstood. There will always be some who misunderstand you. Karl Popper. Thomas Martin did his best to calm the crowd. From the aggrieved look on Martin's face, it seemed to Paul that this stunt was but the latest in a long line of Tesla's rebellions. If Martin's intent had been to claim Tesla as his own, this disaster in progress served to convey precisely the opposite impression. Tesla belonged to no one. And then, quite suddenly, Tesla burst back through the wide double doors. He entered as quickly as he'd departed, but this time he pulled behind him a four-wheeled cart, atop which hung a long black cloth. From the uneven protrusions along the surface of the cloth, it was clear that something strange lay underneath, something that Tesla intended to display at the right moment. Paul couldn't help but be reminded of a magician setting up a trick.
"The subject on which I have the pleasure of carrying to your notices is a novel system of electrical distribution and power transmission."
Tesla's words were delivered at a volume more suited to luncheon with an old friend than to a lecture hall of hundreds. The audience members hushed one another as they struggled to make out what he was saying. Paul looked to Westinghouse. Could the old man even hear a word?
"Alternating currents are the basis of my system's use, as they afford advantages particular over the direct currents common to the terrain in this age and day. I am confident that I will at once establish the superior adaptability of these currents to both the transmission of power and to the ways of motors."
The recently won quiet of the audience broke instantly. Shouts of disbelief came from all corners of the lecture hall. "Alternating current," came the first cry of many. Whatever Tesla was saying seemed deeply controversial. Tesla yanked away the black cloth, revealing three metal devices underneath. To Paul's eye, these devices, each about twice the size of a typewriter, looked to be collections of wire coils, hollow tubes, and strange wheels.
"Forgiveness for me," said Tesla.
As he'd failed to raise his voice, his gentle insistence was lost on most of the audience.
"It would seem that explanations are ordered."
Tesla finally went to the chalkboard and began scribbling equations. It looked to Paul like chicken scratch, but whatever he was writing had a hypnotic effect on the engineers. When Tesla would reach the end of one line and had to pause as he slid the 10 feet leftward to begin writing a new one, there were audible gasps. Paul quickly turned his attention from Tesla to the faces of the crowd. He saw their wrinkling brows as they struggled to piece together what Tesla was showing them. More than a few took out pencil and pad. The product of their own scribblings seemed only to confuse them further. They would look back up at the board and squint their eyes as if to make sure they weren't hallucinating.
"Do you know what all of this means?"
asked Paul of Westinghouse. Paul turned and saw that his client's mouth was literally agape.
Sir?
I'm not sure anyone does, replied Westinghouse.